Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. I'm Dave Stevens, I'm a business marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. Today, we have almost 5,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. I'm delighted to be joined today by speaker, author, and Morris dancer, Duncan Baskerin-Brown. Duncan, welcome to our podcast.
Well, thank you for having me along. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's really good to have you. So for the benefit of our listeners, where in the world do we find you today?
Today, I am in the sunny town of Abingdon, which is just outside Oxford.
And is that where you work, Duncan, or are you guesting there today?
No. That is where I live, where I work, where I Morris dance.
Okay, so I'm interested in the speaking, the authoring, and the Morris dancing. So tell us a bit more about what you do now, and more specifically, this is the Business Marketing podcast. So people will be thinking, oh, how is what Duncan does supporting business marketing?
Well, maybe we will get on to Morris dancing being the original form of marketing at some point. But in a more professional sense, what I do is I help people to get overindulgence. So for me, I spent my time eating a lot of cake, a lot of junk food, and drinking an awful lot of wine. And I very much like talking to creative people, particularly in the business world, because I think there is a bit of a myth about how there's a link between alcohol and creativity. I love unpacking that, and I love to help people to develop personally. And, you know, that gives them so much more energy, so much more focus, which improves their performance at work, in their business. It make you a better Morris dancer.
I will come back to Morris dancing, I promise, but I'm going to stick rigidly with marketing for now.
Sure.
So let's do it down further. How is it that marketers can improve their performance?
Well, I think the thing that I want to share with people is, since I stopped eating rubbish and drinking a lot, I have increased the amount of energy I've got. And that probably doesn't surprise you at all. I mean, if you've ever drunk more than about two glasses of wine or eaten a pizza, you'll know that it does have some effect on your energy. You might be less familiar with the effect that it's got on your focus, your concentration, your memory, but there's an increasing body of scientific evidence out there that says that actually junk food, pizza, ice cream, chocolate, it really does have quite a significant effect on your concentration and your memory. So that's what I want to share with people. You know, it's some simple ways that they can increase their energy and increase their focus, because at the end of the day, you know, what do energy and focus add up to? I mean, it is at the very heart of creativity, isn't it? You know, you need energy and you need concentration.
It sure is. And actually, marketers have, over the years, I think, had a bit of a reputation for indulging quite a lot in alcohol and other stimulants. Therefore, it's kind of a useful reminder, perhaps, that's not the best for our profession.
Yeah, I mean, there's this massive myth that's perpetuated by us, you know, by creative people ourselves, and by some companies that make money out of it as well. But they like to suggest there is this link between alcohol and creativity. And it goes back to Hemingway, it goes back to Mad Men, F. Scott Fitzgerald. You know, the examples out there are legion. But having worked hard as a writer on both sides of the fence. I can assure you that my productivity and the quality of my writing has improved drastically since I stopped drinking.
But there is the counter argument that drinking is associated with increased sociability, and sociability is in turn something that is a good stimulus to creative thinking, right? Helping the mind to make connections beyond the everyday logical.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's an awful lot in what you just said to sort of like get at that kind of sociability side of it. I find that when you go to a networking event, so it's going to be an early morning breakfast event, something like that, you're going to be nervous, aren't you? And those sort of like that first 15, 20 minutes, it's going to be a little bit difficult. It's going to be a little bit uncomfortable, but you relax into it, don't you? And you actually find that in the evening, when you go down to the pub, the same is true. You feel a little bit nervous. You feel a little bit uncomfortable for about 15, 20 minutes, but that actually goes. And the thing is, because most of the time, that first 15 or 20 minutes in the pub, people are drinking beer or wine or spirits, they assume that they are more relaxed and that they are more sociable because of the alcohol. But it's not. It's just that situation. You know, it's exactly the same as if you were at a breakfast networking event. You just relax into it. You just start chatting. The conversation flows naturally. So getting you over that initial hurdle of feeling nervous, feeling a little bit uncomfortable in social situations, I don't think alcohol really helps that at all. But it does, of course, have an effect later on in the evening. I mean, there's one thing about having a great idea. There's another thing about actually being able to remember it in the morning, isn't there? So, yes, it can disrupt your thought patterns. And for a long time, I genuinely believed that I needed to slow my thinking down. And alcohol was a great way of doing that. But, looking back on that, it's like, that is actually a crazy thing to think. I know that I have produced much more creative work. I've made more connections within my work sober than I ever did drinking.
What are the substitutes, though? Of course, I believe everything that you say, Duncan, and so of course I'm going to go away and take that to heart. But actually, is there something more than that I can hold on to here? Is there an appropriate substitute?
Well, I've never been a massive fan of substituting stuff because for my money, if you want to stop doing something, if you want to remove something from your lifestyle, whether that's junk food, whether that's alcohol, whether it's cigarettes, whether it's doom scrolling Facebook, it doesn't really matter. That is much easier to do if you've come to the conclusion that it's not actually serving you. And if you've realized that it's not helping you or supporting you, then it's quite easy not to do it. I mean, I'm sure you can think of a number of things that you don't do because you don't want to do them. Not because you actually have to actively use willpower or anything. However, if you sort of like build up this idea of a substitute, then what you're saying to yourself is that it is actually fulfilling a need. It is actually doing something for you. And therefore, you're creating that sense that you're missing out on something, that you are actually losing something that's beneficial, when in actual fact, you're probably removing something from your life that isn't serving you and that isn't helping you.
And I've kind of glossed a little bit over the connection with well-being. So I wonder if you could perhaps unpack that for us a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the amount of evidence that's building up about the damage for alcohol, for example, it's getting quite large. My favourite piece of science that I quote quite a lot at people was a group of scientists. They took alcohol and they put it through all of the tests that you'd have to put a food additive through if you wanted to make this a legal food additive. And they put it through the tests and they came to the conclusion that the safe dose for alcohol is 2 units. Most people turn around and go, well, yeah, 2 units a day, that's fine, I can stick to that. It wasn't 2 units a day. And then they go, oh, well, 2 units a week, that's a bit strong. And it wasn't 2 units a week, 2 units a month? That's just ridiculous. Wasn't actually 2 units a month. If alcohol was invented today and you wanted to put it in food, the safe maximum dose would be 2 units a year.
Whoa.
Yeah, whoa indeed. Now, I'm not saying that like alcohol is, you know, just any of it is gonna ruin your life. But it is one of those things that it is rather difficult to only drink a small amount. I mean, certainly for me, it was pretty much an impossibility. A number of times I'd say to myself, well, I only have one drink. And, you know, once you've had one drink, it lowers your inhibitions. It affects your decision making process. So you end up drinking more than you would perhaps want. And the physical effects of alcohol, you know, we all know about that. I mean, if you've ever drunk more than about 2 glasses, you'll know what it does to you. But I think the mental health implications of alcohol are starting to become more and more obvious. Sadly, we've seen a lot of people increasing their drinking throughout lockdown as a way to cope. And of course, realizing that actually it just makes things a whole lot worse.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of come a little bit to kind of case studies to back up your argument, but I guess first and foremost, what's your own personal experience here? Would you like to take us through a little bit of your story that kind of gets you to the point of advocating the case for well-being over alcohol?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I started off with chocolate and sugary, fatty food that they give to kids because, you know, it's fairly socially acceptable for a 9-year-old to overdo it on the dairy milk, isn't it? And, you know, I used that as a coping mechanism. As school was not really set up for the likes of me, so I didn't get on too well with my teachers, and I was kind of like trying to run away from my life, really. And I existed quite happily on sweeties for a little while, but you know, you grow up, don't you? And I discovered alcohol when I was around 14, 15, and found that it had a bit more of an effect. And of course, you know, I started off the way a lot of people do. You know, I'd only drink in social situations. It's all right, I'd only drink on the weekends. But of course, the weekends started to get a little bit longer and longer. You know, I had one weekend that actually lasted for about 20 years. And that was when I realized that maybe it was time to do something about it. Sadly, I didn't have one of those great 4 a.m. staring into the mirror in the toilet moments like you're supposed to have. I just met this wonderful lady, and she sort of gently encouraged me to change my lifestyle. So I started off, I gave up smoking to start off with, and as our relationship developed, we wanted to have kids. Unfortunately, she had a miscarriage, and you know, that was really hard on both of us. I didn't really know how to deal with that. I didn't know how to cope with that. So I did what I knew, which of course was drinking a lot, and that spectacularly didn't help. And I basically got to a point where, you know, it was never obviously stated, but there was this bit in my mind that was saying, well, you know, it's time to make your choice. What do you want? Do you want a kid, or do you want to have another drink? And I clearly made the right decision, because almost 9 months to the day after I stopped drinking, my daughter was born, and she's fantastic. She is worth all of those drunken nights. Definitely, you know, she's wonderful, fills me full of joy. After she was born, my wife had some mental health problems, and you know, things got to a point, and I never wanted to go back to drinking, but I found myself increasing the amount of chocolatey cookies that I was eating, reaching for the ice cream, and it got to a point where it started to dawn on me that I was eating the way I used to drink. So I had another kind of one of those moments where it was like, well, this is great, but do you want another tub of ice cream, or do you want to be a decent parent to your daughter? So thankfully, again, I made the right decision, went half a vegan leather substitute into a whole food plant-based diet, lost a ton of weight, gained a huge amount of calm and peace and vitality. And, you know, energy and focus, those are the things that I really can't get over how much they increased when I really finally sorted out my diet, got myself into a really healthy place. And I'm in my mid-40s now, and I feel better than I did 20 years ago.
Well, that's great. It's a really compelling story. Thank you for sharing that. The thing, though, I'd still love to kind of explore a little bit more with you is there's kind of a difference between thinking, oh, actually, to get my own personal life right for me, I need to do these things, and right for my daughter and right for my wife, I need to do these sort of things. And that's kind of one area. And it's a laudable area to follow and to get things right. But it's another to actually, having done that, move into a place where you are a speaker, an author, an advocate around it. So it's kind of almost, you've almost gone one further step there, and I'd love to understand why and how.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, all of the time that I was drinking, I wanted to write. I wanted to express my feelings about the world. You know, I wanted to get my creative product out there, kind of thing. But I never did. I'd scribble away a little bit here and there, but, you know, lacked any kind of real momentum with it. So when I stopped drinking, I discovered that I had quite a lot more time. I never thought that I spent that much time drinking, because I never drank during the day. You know, I was never vodka on the cornflakes kind of a guy. I'd work hard. I'd go to work, get my work done, come home, do a few things. I was very involved in local government at the time. I'd typically go to quite a lot of very exciting meetings. And, then I'd come home and then I'd drink. And so I was like typical high functioning kind of drinker. And when I stopped, I realized I had so much more time. So I started investing some of it in developing some coaching and training. It sort of happened a little bit by accident, because what I found was, in local government, I'd held a few fairly high profile roles. People had been quite impressed with the work that I'd done, so they would occasionally ask me, you know, how can you help me to replicate that? So kind of accidentally was getting a little bit into coaching and training, and then all of a sudden I had all of this time. So I actually thought, well, I might as well do something with it. And from that, it developed into a kind of coaching and training business. I wrote my first book, and I was enjoying that. But what I realized was, the stuff that I did in local government, you know, was good. I'm proud of what I achieved. But actually, the greatest thing that I achieved was the transformation. That's really what I want to share with people. I cannot get over it. You know, every day I wake up in the morning, I'm full of life, I'm happy to be alive. And that's the joy that I want to share with people. So I thought, well, how can I use these coaching, training, writing, speaking skills that I've developed? And I trained with an organization called the Easy Way Clinic, which is the world's most successful stop smoking clinics. I did my apprenticeship there, as it were. I still do some work for them, which is great. I get to steal about £10 million a year off the tobacco industry, which fills me full of joy. And, you know, working through that, working through, you know, hundreds of people a year, helping them to remove smoking from their lives, I realized that there's a lot of parallels between smoking and drinking and doom scrolling Facebook, eating junk, taking drugs, gambling, you name it. It all works along the same mechanism. So I thought I would try and branch out and help people to overcome some of those other issues.
And your kind of personal example is really clear, but I wonder if there are maybe one or two other case studies that you want to highlight, for us of maybe people who have gone through similar experiences and ended up in a place where they've been much more creative as a result, or had a better life as a result. Are there other examples you'd like to share?
I worked with a guy the other day, and he'd um, he joined the Marines straight out of school. So he'd gone through the Royal Marine training course, which is, it's a whole year, longest infantry course in the world. He'd excelled as a Royal Marine. He joined the SBS. He'd done, I think, about 6 or 7 years in the SBS. So, you know, you think about somebody like that and you think discipline, willpower, self-control, he must have it in spades. And, you know, to get through the all of those selection processes, he clearly does. But he was really struggling to control his drinking. And I kind of like worked with him and helped him to see that he had been going about it the wrong way. He'd been trying to power through. He'd been trying to use his willpower, you know, his strength against it. And I think that's a problem that we often have as men, is we bang our heads against things, don't we? And, you know, the solution to drinking too much, eating too much, smoking, whatever, it's not about strength. It's not about willpower. Willpower is a finite resource. I'm sure you've had that thing where you mean to do it, but then life just kind of wears you down a little bit. Psychologists call that ego fatigue. And I helped him to manage the thought process and to think about the emotional temperature that sat underneath everything that he was doing. And those some really simple stuff about identifying the that little voice in his head. Now, I'm not saying he had voices in his head in that sense, but we all have that little part of our brain that says to us, oh, go on then, let's have a drink, or let's have a slice of cake, or let's stick on Call of Duty on the games console, whatever. We all have that voice in our head that tells us to do that. So I helped him to identify that. And then once he'd identified that, he gave it a name. He called it Cassandra, as it happens. I'm not quite sure why, but I like people to give it a name, because that makes sure you're really, really clear absolutely who you're dealing with. I used to call mine Hank, by the way. Yeah. And once he'd identified, given her a name, then we worked on helping him to develop a question to ask that. So whenever Cassandra was saying, let's have a drink, he was then saying, yeah, but how's that going to help me reach my goals for 2022? So he had some quite ambitious goals that he wanted to do. He'd come out of the Marines and he was looking to start his own business. So he had some quite ambitious goals that he was trying to achieve. So we got him to ask Cassandra, how's that going to help him achieve his goals? And of course, she doesn't have an answer to that question. So I really helped him to control the thought process. And once you can do that, it really does make the behavior part of it quite easy.
That's a really interesting example. There were people who have been listening to what you've been saying, and it's been really resonating for them. It's kind of one thing to listen to you and think, oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's another to take action. And to take action over something like this can feel huge. Where do you start?
Well, I always try and get people to identify what their number one problem is. And everybody's got one, and usually it's not that hard. And we then just work on that number one problem. Quite often we start with smoking, because that's where a lot of people got into it. A lot of people start smoking quite early. And I can get into the biology of it and the neurology of it. It's quite dull, but that kind of prompts these urges and these cravings, and they get bigger and bigger. And you try and satisfy them with other things. Might be alcohol, might be drugs, might be gambling. And it all kind of escalates from there. But we take what is their number one problem, and we use that method. You know, identify the voice in your head, give it a name, ask it a question, solve that problem, and then we find out what their new number one problem is, and then we work on that, and then we find out what their new number one problem is once they've solved that. And there's good news and there's bad news. You know, that each individual problem is relatively straightforward to solve. That's the good news. The bad news is, of course, that you do end up with a new number one problem and you just have to keep solving that. And so I encourage people to kind of like see it as a journey. I mean, I don't know how many years you're planning on living for, Dave, but I expect it's a few. And that means, you know, you're going to keep changing. You're going to try and keep improving as you move forward. So that's the way I kind of encourage people to look at it. It's not about doing one thing. It's about that continuous journey of self-improvement. And it's sort of like swimming, isn't it? You know, if you stop, you drown. But even like a gentle doggy paddle will keep you going. I mean, you don't have to do any cold water triathlon Olympic level swimming. Just a little doggy paddle. That's all you need just to keep moving forward.
It's a nice way of looking at it. You mentioned your book. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so it came out just at the end of March. It's called Get Over Indulgence. It really is my story. And I'm very pleased with the reaction that I'm getting from people. I hear a lot of people say that they've read it in one sitting, which is good because that's what I wanted. I wanted it to be short. It is not a weighty tome by any stretch of the imagination. So it's pretty accessible. I also get a lot of people telling me that it's quite funny, which I'm quite pleased with. So yeah, it's my journey from junk food through alcohol all the way back to health. And it also contains the system that I used to get myself out of it. So I like to think of it as a self-help novella, because that means, you know, I'm in a category of one, aren't I, really? So, yeah, it's called Get Over Indulgence. It's on Amazon. It's on Audible. It's available at your local bookshop.
Fabulous. Thank you for that. And if people want to find out more about you, Duncan, can they reach out to you? What's the best way of connecting?
Well, frankly, if you can spell my name, I am really easy to find. There's a pesky H hidden in Baskaran that makes it a bit harder to find me. But if you can you can spell Duncan Baskaran Brown, then you can find me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my work.
And your name will be in the show notes as well if people want to reference to it. So I've got to ask finally about the Morris dancing then. Given that we're recording this sort of in May, I'm imagining it's peak season.
Yeah, we just got started. We've been doing a little bit of dancing. It's great. I mean, I'm very lucky to live in Abingdon because we have a fantastic Morris tradition that dates back to the 1600s. You know, it's sort of crazy to be part of something that's that old, really. And they're a great bunch of lads. And we just go out and we have fun. We dance. We wear silly hats. We talk nonsense. You know, what's not to like?
And all without the help of alcohol or tobacco.
Well, to be honest with you, some of them do drink. It is true. But I am pretty much the world's only sober Morris dancer. And I don't know, but I think you could probably make the case that Morris dancing is a form of marketing, because the way I see it, it was what the acne scarred artisans did back in the Middle Ages. You know, they all danced around and they were trying to prove to the ladies that they were the fittest, you know, that they had the best genes, that they could jump higher than the other plow herds or whatever. And they were advertising themselves. So, yes.
I'm already imagining the activity for the next Business Marketing Club event. Duncan, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been great.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed sharing my story. Thank you.
And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guest, Duncan Baskaran Brown. And thanks to our technical man from Through the Eye, Andrew Gratian. Thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.